This is a recording of the rulemaking hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on September 17, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
It's special session of the Federal Election Commission will reconvene. Second panel is Mr. Paul Ryan of the Campaign Legal Center, Mark Elias here as Mark Elias on behalf of a client, and Craig Holman here on behalf of Public Citizen. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We're using the lights. Thought that'd be a nice touch. The green light at the witness table will start to flash when the person speaking has 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on with 30 seconds, and red means wrap it up. The balance of time is reserved for questioning by the commission and general counsel and the office of staff director. How we did the first panel, you probably came in at some point, is more of a free form. My preference is more the Chairman Lenhardt model, where commissioners can drill down on particular issues and not necessarily in an orderly fashion take turns, because as a former witness, I found that it gets frustrating when you get on a roll and then the time expires and another commissioner starts asking about something else, and three commissioners later you come back to the topic that was almost exhausted. So I think that the more flowing system works for me. So with that, we default, I guess, to the alphabet, or drawing straws. With no straws, we'll do the alphabet. So Mr. Elias, you win the alphabet game.
Well, I'm going to be brief and not use my full 5 minutes, hopefully, and answer the questions that you all have. Let me first repeat at the outset that I'm here only as a private citizen. As I said to someone earlier, petitioning my government for redress of my grievances. And I'm not here on behalf of any client. I have a number of clients with different, with no doubt differing views from each other on these topics. I decided that I would submit comments on my own behalf, really to represent only my own views on these and no one else's. So I hope that that's understood and respected. I also wanted to say at the outset what a pleasure it is to be before the newly reconstituted Federal Election Commission. I have testified on a number of matters with the chairman in rulemakings in the past, and it is therefore both a pleasure and slightly intimidating to now be testifying before him. To add to this pressure, I have two former Senate staffers who were present during the consideration and passage of this very piece of legislation, and one commissioner who has made it a good chunk of her professional life trying to move towards bundling disclosure more generally. So I will be brief in my introduction, but it is truly a pleasure to be here today, and particularly to be here today testifying on an issue that is really a blank canvas. It is rare for those of us who were not in practice in the mid-70s to have an opportunity to address an issue that really has never been addressed before by the commission. And in that sense, this is kind of a historic opportunity to sort of take a new concept. Even in some sense, McCain-Feingold was the implementation of old concepts that had a new statutory framework. But this is really an opportunity to testify on something that is wholly new. And with that in mind, I want to back up. I heard only portions of the panel before me, but I want to back up and sort of take this to what I think is its most basic level. What I understood Congress to be doing, from my vantage point, was something very, very simple, which is that at the end of the night, okay, the end of the night of a successful fundraiser, or the end of a quarter of a successful fundraising period, or an unsuccessful fundraising period, a member of Congress or a candidate would sit back with their finance director and they'd say, geez, this was a good quarter, this was a good event. How'd we raise the money? And it wouldn't be based on pro rata. It wouldn't be based on double counting. It would be based on, frankly, what campaigns do, which is that they know they raised $200,000, and they can tell you to the penny who raised that money. Why? Because that's their business. Their business is in being able to track money and report it accurately. So on one of the central issues in this rulemaking, I'll just preview for you, I oppose both the pro rata and the double counting approach. To me, the answer ought to be nothing more complicated than the subjective, not objective, but the subjective belief that the member and the campaign have about who raised the money. Why is that? Well, let me step even further back how we wound up with this legislation. We wound up with this legislation because the Bush campaign did something very clever. And I say that as the former general counsel to the Kerry Edwards campaign. It was clever and successful, which is it came up with a very, very sophisticated system of tracking who was raising money for it, and then it gave them titles and it gave them codes. So that the Bush campaign at any one time could tell you that person X had raised and was credited with having raised $100,000 or $250,000 or $188,253.72. They tracked it, they credited it through records and other forms of designation, titles and the like, and they were able to then keep that internal. Well, the press came along and said, well, if you know that internally, why don't you tell us? And now Congress has come along and said, if you know this, come and tell us. No one ever questioned whether or not the ranger or the pioneer had a right to be reported or tracked a certain way. It was always from the standpoint of the Bush campaign. Why? Because if the Bush campaign believed you raised $250,000, that's what mattered, right? In the eyes of the public, in the eyes of disclosure, what mattered was what does the office holder or the candidate believe the lobbyist has done for them? Because that's presumably what's significant in whether or not that lobbyist is going to receive some special benefit or preference down the road. So I want to begin by saying that I think we should simplify this down from where I think we've gotten slightly. And the standard for all of these things ought to be, what did the campaign believe? What did they track? What did they credit? And that's what ought to be in reality reported. One other small point that I wanted to make. The original bill, and I think there was some disagreement among us on the panel, the original bill, as it was introduced in the Senate, would have tracked by event. That was replaced by a different system, which was not to report by event, but to report by person credited. And I think that rather than focus as much as people have on who is the co-host of an event, we ought to go back to that the principle of what was in the final bill, which is who gets credit for the money raised. Thank you. I took, in fact, my full 5 minutes. I apologize, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Hellman.
Hello. Do I begin?
Yes, Mr. Hellman. Sorry. Yes.
Chairman and Commission, thank you for letting me testify before you about Section 204, which is probably the single most important provision of S1 and the new lobbying law. When it comes to keeping a paper trail of bundling activity, it isn't always done as precisely and as systematically as George Bush would lead us to believe. George Bush was phenomenal at keeping records as to his bundling activity. But we found that some of the newer candidates, such as John McCain specifically, is not as diligent at record keeping on bundling as George Bush used to be. First of all, I want to emphasize how important this issue is. The public has never really had a very good clue as to what sort of role lobbyists have been playing in the fundraising game until now. And with the new LD-203 reports, for instance, we find that there's about $200 million being brought in the first half of this year just by lobbyists and registrants through various activities, which is far more than what most of us expected. Meanwhile, all this activity has been done within the shadows for the most part. Public Citizen has set up a web page that we've had in operation since the early 2000s trying to track bundling activity in the presidential campaigns. And by the way, it's a mantle that I gladly turn over to you. Our webpage, whitehouseforsale.org, has tried monitoring who the bundlers are and how much they're bringing in. And with the Bush campaign, we had an easier time of monitoring that because Bush kept very, very precise records. He had his pioneer program going on. With the 2008 campaign, it's been a lot more like pulling teeth, trying to identify who the bundlers are. While Obama has provided us with fairly systematic records, McCain has provided us with general records, and only after we keep asking him, in your opinion, in your knowledge, have we properly identified who your bundlers are? Just to show you how important this is, at this point we've identified more than 3,000 bundlers involved in the presidential campaigns, and they tend to oftentimes, which is what we're looking for, is a mutual benefit that bundlers get with the presidential campaigns. We identify that of all Bush bundlers, 24% of them have received some form of governmental appointment within the Bush administration. So there is, tends to be, a reciprocal relation going on. But before my time runs out, I want to get to this point that you've been debating all morning. And that is, what is an appropriate means of recognizing to credit a bundler? We found that with the John McCain campaign, we kept on asking him, who are your bundlers? And we wouldn't get an answer. Especially early in the campaign, because I think the campaign was operating on a shoestring. They weren't probably keeping, I don't know, accurate records that one would expect. But it also appears that the McCain campaign doesn't really assign this tracking number that the Bush campaign is known for. Instead, we would have to go and winnow through McCain's webpage to try to identify what he labeled as chief fundraisers. Major fundraisers for the campaign. And we would post those major fundraisers using the title concept that that this NPRM recognizes as perhaps an appropriate means of recognizing who the bundlers are. But then we wouldn't know for sure if that title was an accurate depiction. So we would then send a letter to McCain and ask him, McCain, we're asking you your knowledge. Have we identified the bundlers? Is this an accurate list? And from the response we get from McCain, that's what we develop as our list of bundlers. So just to address that one issue, it is imperative that you go beyond any kind of traditional written records, even go beyond the Bush Pioneer tracking program, because that will not always be accurate. There are, in fact, campaigns that are using a much more informal system of fundraising, and it is the campaign that knows who their bundlers are, and without necessarily a paper trail. There are other issues that I hope we can address in the question and answers, but I see the time period's running out. And by the way, I'm very delighted with the draft of the NPRM. I mean, this is something that I found getting very close to hanging on to the spirits and the letter of the new law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. It's a pleasure to be here this morning on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center. The principle behind the disclosure provisions at issue in this rulemaking is simple. It's to shed light on a growing campaign finance practice of lobbyists bundling large sums of money to influence federal candidates in an effort to gain access to office holders and influence the decisions that they make. And to this end, Congress included in the legislation itself a direction to this commission as to how it should proceed in crafting these regulations that we're here to discuss today. The Commission shall provide for, quote, the broadest possible disclosure, unquote, of the bundling activities described in the statute. This unusual statutory directive to the Commission is not simply legislative history. This is the law itself. This directive must guide the Commission in this rulemaking process. I want to discuss a couple of specific issues raised in the NPRM itself. Under the statutory scheme, a reporting committee must file a separate report for each covered period in which the committee received two or more bundled contributions in excess of the $15,000 threshold amount from a lobbying registrant. The NPRM sets forth three different options for how to define this term covered period, two of which are detailed rather extensively, and there's actually draft regulatory language at the end of the NPRM. A third proposal is simply mentioned in the text, in lieu of either the proposed rule or the alternative. For the reasons that are detailed in the written comments we submitted, the Campaign Legal Center supports the third proposal, which would require committees to report both semiannual and quarterly information at the end of each semiannual period. Further, we suggest in our written comments that the Commission modify this third approach by also requiring a committee to report an aggregate amount bundled within a calendar year by any given bundler, where a report on that bundler would otherwise be required by the statute. I'm happy to discuss with you what I perceive to be the benefits of this approach versus the drawbacks to the other two proposals in the NPRM if you have questions on that point. But I'll move on at this point to the definition of bundled contribution. The NPRM raises three important questions regarding the definition of bundled contributions. The first regards employees of lobbying organizations who are not registrants themselves. The Campaign Legal Center is of the view, and we state this in our written comments, that lobbying organizations engage in reportable bundling when an employee bundles money as an agent for the lobbying organization, even if that employee is not a registrant himself or herself. The statutory trigger is whether contributions are credited by the committee or candidate to the registrant organization. The second issue regarding the definition of bundled contribution relates to the treatment of fundraising events, and this is an issue that was discussed extensively in the first panel. The NPRM raises the question of how the reporting requirement should be applied where there are multiple lobbyists who co-host a fundraising event. Where two or more registrants co-host the same fundraising event, the recipient should credit the entire amount raised at the event as having been raised by each of the registrant co-hosts. This interpretation is undoubtedly consistent with the views of the sponsors, the principal sponsors of this legislation, as we detailed in our written comments, citing to the congressional record. And the alternative of dividing the total proceeds of the event by the number of co-hosts and attributing only that amount to each registrant would mark an easy path to evasion of any disclosure at all. It's for that reason that we oppose that approach. The third issue that I want to raise is the definition of within the definition of bundled contributions, the meaning of the phrase designations or other means of recognizing. A bundled contribution is one where the recipient candidate or committee credits the funds to the registrant through records, designations, or other means of recognizing that a certain amount of money has been raised by the registrant. Importantly, the proposed rule, it enumerates means of recognizing as illustrative and not exclusive or exhaustive. This is the correct approach, I believe. There are a wide variety of ways in which a candidate or recipient committee can give credit to a bundler as having raised a certain amount of money, and those means of recognition can be written or unwritten. Indeed, the Commission's own regulatory definition of earmarked incorporates or recognizes this reality by including formal and informal, written and unwritten, oral or written earmarking. As detailed in our written comments, the three principal sponsors of this provision, Representative Van Hollen in the House and Senators Feingold and Obama, pointed out that crediting the lobbyist simply means that the recipient, candidate, or committee knows that the contributions have been raised by the lobbyist. And indeed, the root of the word recognizing is conoscere, which is the Latin for the verb to know. That's what's at the heart of all of this. So I have no further comments. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I thought I'd take advantage of the fact that Mr. Elias is not representing anyone. And now we'll get your personal views exactly, I hope, and how you feel about a couple issues.
Hopefully just related to the rulemaking.
shucks. Well, anyway. Going to the issue of a couple of points you made, I tend to really sympathize with the fact that proration seems quite arbitrary to me. I mean, I recognize that it's a way to show that it was shared somehow, but it seems in a number of ways it could be quite arbitrary. So I would be comfortable with the allocation or the subjective decision of the recipient on how that would be done. But I'm wondering, would you have any problem if there was a second column there? It wouldn't necessarily say they're credited with raising it, but it would be informational to show it was part of an event that raised $150,000.
I would, for the following reasons. There are two reasons. One, I don't think the statute supports it, which is sort of a baseline test. But at a practical level, my opposition to it is a practical one. I listened a little bit in interest to the prior panel on this. Events are not static things. Sometimes someone gets listed as a co-host and they don't raise money because they flame out on you. Sometimes they get listed as a co-host because it's a favor to someone else who is raising money for you. Sometimes they have raised money for you in the past, but they're not raising now, and therefore they get listed as a co-host. Sometimes they get listed as a co-host because, frankly, the event isn't going well, and adding their name adds some heft to an event that isn't raising much at all. And sometimes they get added as a co-host because they are themselves prominent So you might add a prominent trial lawyer as a co-host if you're doing a trial lawyer event to make it look like, yay, trial lawyers, come give money because look who's the co-host, much in the same way you might list a senator as hosting an event. So my problem with the co-host, this idea that we're going to trigger off of co-hosts, is that of all of the things that from my experience campaigns track, that is, it's like titles, you know. You want to be the deputy, you know, Northwestern chairman of the you know, the zebra-loving, zebra-lovers for Smith campaign? Great. How much are you going to give? Right? I mean, it's putting their name as a co-host doesn't signify what I think the NPRM suggests that it does, which is some actual economic stake in what money is raised. In fact, on the prior panel, I heard someone say, well, we know that the money was raised by the co-host generally, and that isn't even true. I mean, very often, in my experience, campaigns will use someone's home, and they will be listed as the host, and the host raises zippy, right? They've provided the home. All the money is being raised by people who aren't on the invitation at all. So I think that this keying off of kind of what's on the invitation and who's listed as a co-host is frankly a bit off the path of frankly what Congress is trying to get at. And what I think, frankly, would be more accurate disclosure. So,
can I just to follow up on that point? There is a difference between all that and actual formal crediting.
Correct. My experience is that campaigns, they will credit the person who raised the money, who they believe deserves credit, because it's important to them. Because if Commissioner Weintraub says to Smith, I'm going to raise you $50,000, but if you did, they are going to credit the $50,000. And sometimes they'll fight with Weintraub over it. Weintraub will say, but I raised the Peterson money. And the campaign will say, you didn't raise the Peterson money. What are you out of your mind? The Peterson money came in through McGahn. Right? That wasn't, and so the campaigns are interested in this in part because the donors are interested in it, but also in part because they're putting together a budget. They say we need to raise $200,000. We're going to find 10 people to each raise 20, and they need to have a system internally to have some accountability. Now, what if they don't have that system? If they have that system, then they offer then they give some credit for it. If they don't, well, then frankly, I assume we're in a place where the gentleman to my left and I. Fair to say it's rare that for the FEC I am the person most to the right.
Congratulations.
The gentleman to my left should be thrilled because if campaigns don't track what lobbyists have raised, presumably they're happier because then there's no credit being given to lobbyists. Lobbyists have no sway over the campaign. Nothing gets reported, but everyone, the campaign doesn't know the lobbyists raised it. There's a total break between money and lobbyists. So,
Mark, flip side, though, is really, as a practical matter, real campaigns, and even the ones who aren't real but are convinced by consultants that they're real, hire professional fundraisers who track all kinds of stuff, not because they're necessarily crediting, because they need that information to know who to go back. Now,
you raise a separate question, which is in my comments, and which I was hoping that someone was going to ask you about, which is I do think the commission needs to define the word credit. It wants to define what comes after credit, but it doesn't define credit. And to me, you wouldn't credit through records if records were credit. In other words, you wouldn't need, if all they meant was that you kept a record or had a or other form of designation, they would have just said that is kept in a record or other form of designation. The fact they used the word credit to me connotes something more than that, and I think the commission ought to engage in some probing as to what it is it means to credit a contribution to someone.
Could I offer a response a little bit since I was brought up in here?
That probably makes sense to drill down on this a little bit while we're hot on this one, because this is an issue that I raised in the first panel, and everyone looked at me like I had three heads. But there's a difference between what the fundraisers keep record-wise and what's actually crediting, and does it even matter, and can the rule even reflect that distinction? I don't know. But
first of all, I want to clarify that McCain is keeping track. He's just not doing the tracking numbers, to my knowledge. He gives credit to those that he believes are out hosting fundraisers and collecting a great deal of money for him, and he calls them co-chairs and financial chairs within his committee. It's just he's not using the system, to my knowledge, where each of these financial chairs are assigned a number and the number gets written on the memo check. It's just more McCain's knowledge of who's bringing in the money for him. So this, he is keeping track of this. Bundling is as much, if not more important, in the McCain campaign than it was in the Bush campaign. McCain does have 850 bundlers that we've been able to identify. And
but this rule is going to apply to someone else other than John McCain, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm just talking about McCain because
he's... One point of frustration I've always had with the commission, we tend to talk presidential as if that is illustrative to all their campaigns. And I always come at it from sort of the smaller campaign perspective. So I understand McCain may or may not be tracking and all that. And if that helps me understand what the smaller campaigns go through, then keep going. But let's assume, arguendo, McCain's tracking somehow, and how he tracks would be something that would be crediting.
All right. My next point was going to focus more on the congressional campaigns.
Okay,
with the presidential campaigns, it's easier to try to identify these 850 bundlers just because it's higher profile. When we get to the smaller campaigns, especially the congressional campaigns, that's where it's important to make sure that any of the hosts or organizers of a fundraising event get counted for their bundling activity generally because of their hosts, because a smaller campaign isn't going to keep the same type of records that most of the presidential campaigns are going to keep. You brought up earlier this morning an example in which you hypothesized a fundraising event, I presume for a congressional candidate, where three lobbyists are hosting it, but one walks in with checks for $20,000, the other two walks in with checks for $5,000, which is in fact mixing two different types of crediting. I presume that is the Bush style of pioneer crediting, in which a lobbyist actually walks in with $20,000 worth of checks that are credited specifically to that lobbyist. If there's a written trail that identifies specific lobbyists, then that ought to be the method that's being used. But in most of these fundraising events, you just have sort of ambiguous a list of hosts that are hosting a fundraising event, and people show up and write a check to the general campaign or the fundraising event itself. That's where each of the hosts need to be credited equally, because it is impossible otherwise to identify the relative weights that any particular host had in a fundraising event unless they walk in with checks that said, Joe brought in this check.
So you agree, though, assume the facts, my hypothetical, are correct. You know to a metaphysical certainty that lobbyist A walks in with $20,000 worth of bundle checks. Lobbyist B has five, and lobbyist C comes in with five. That their report ought to reflect that reality, and it should not be automatically prorated in that instance?
If you have a system of written crediting, a tracking system, then I would prefer that system in terms of crediting who gets the funds. In the case of a fundraising event, absent a tracking system, absent any written records, then each of the hosts, whoever the campaign, ought to be credited equal amount in terms of the fundraising event. When it comes to fundraising events, it's going to be the latter. You don't really have fundraising events where the hosts walk in with the checks already written out and credited to the fundraiser. They wouldn't even need to host in events then. They could just get the checks and hand over the checks. If you have a written system, you know, that ought to predominate, but where I'm most concerned is these fundraising events in which there isn't a particular tracking mechanism provided.
Nebulous, and there's just hosts. It's actually, this was all of the vice chair's questions, so, and then once the vice chair.
I have one more question, and I'd like to start with Mr. Elias and then ask anybody else how they feel. I hear your position, but we have a situation where we're told how we must interpret the statute. So our views don't necessarily have to prevail here. It is what is the broadest possible disclosure. That's the law. It's legislative intent legislated. So then you say, okay, the broadest possible disclosure. If somebody is acting as a team, a fundraiser, otherwise they don't need to have a fundraiser if they're going to walk in with five checks and 10 checks. They're there to help each other raise money. and maybe not only at that event, but in the future. And it is always nebulous. It can't be necessarily identified exactly in terms of monetary terms. So if somebody is going to, like the campaign, is going to do some crediting when they report, what would be wrong with letting the public know that it was part of a team effort and show how much money was raised, and then let the public be the judge if it wants that, okay, this person got 2% credit or 90% credit, but in any event, credit was given and there was an event that helped generate it. Given the statutory language that we're under here.
A couple of things. One is the statutory language is to do it as broadly as possible, consistent with the terms of the statute. So I read the statute as requiring the disclosure by campaigns of contributions credited to them through designation or other means of recognition. And if it's not credited to them, then we can be as expansive as we want. We can say we're going to be as expansive as possible. But if it does not meet that threshold test, which is why I think a definition of crediting is so important, if it does not meet that threshold test of having been credited to them, then we're just talking about a different statute. We're talking about a statute that they could have written, which, by the way, the prior panel was correct, was in the original version of the bill, which was replaced in its entirety with a different bill, which was event-based. The original bill would have required people who host events to disclose, lobbyists who host events to disclose the contributions raised at events they host to the Secretary of the Senate, Clerk of the House. That language, gone. Replaced with this, which was FEC reporting based on contributions credited. So to me, again, I think there's a relatively simple way to deal with this. And I think we keep complicating it because we keep looking at it from the perspective of the lobbyists. And I would tell everyone to take a step back and go back to what this is trying to do, which is, what does the campaign believe? What do they think? Do they believe that lobbyist A raised 20 and lobbyist B raised 25? Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. It doesn't seem to me it matters. What matters is what they believe, because that's who's going to get the juice, right? That's what you're trying to figure out, what lobbyist is getting the juice with the member. And the one that's going to get the juice is based on what the member and the campaign believes happened. So I think it's not as important whether it's written or complex or not. What we ought to be doing is trying to get as accurate a picture of what the campaign believed an individual lobbyist did.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask Mr. Ryan about that, because I think I really appreciated your opening comments, Mark, because it went to something that I've been thinking about, which is, what's our charge here? Is our charge to tell people how to credit the lobbyists, or to find out how the committees are crediting the lobbyists and make sure that that is accurately reported to the public? So what's your reaction to the idea that what we should really be focusing on is, you know, however we define credit, we'll get to that, however the campaigns are crediting the lobbyists, that's what we should be trying to get the accurate disclosure of?
I think your responsibility is twofold, and it is to identify how these campaigns are crediting these funds that are being raised. But the second part of your responsibility is to avoid drawing roadmaps for ways or opening up channels through which these requirements can be evaded. Vice Chairman Walter raised some very good points during the first panel about how in much of the country these fundraising practices may be much less formal than we are used to here in Washington, D.C., specifically with respect to the co-hosted fundraisers, for example. You know, in the comments, the written comments that were submitted by the principal sponsors of this legislation, they address this issue and express explicitly their concern on page 6 of the comments from Senators Feingold, Obama, and Representative Van Hollen. They state, lobbyists and campaigns could try to game the system by dividing the amount raised at an event among a large number of lobbyists, thereby making sure that none of them reach the reporting threshold. So I think it's possible to design the reporting system, the reporting requirements, the forms that are required to be completed in that process in such a way as to attribute the full amount raised at a co-hosted fundraise event to each of the registrants who are there co-hosting it, but also to include perhaps as a memo, and I think Senator Feingold suggested this on the floor of the Senate, including as part of that disclosure form, a listing of the other co-hosts of the event. Perhaps this is not something that we got into in our written comments, what I'm about to say, but perhaps you could even invite reporters to you know, the candidates and committees reporting to elaborate on that list of co-hosts with what they perceive to be the specific specific dollar amounts that each of the registrant co-hosts were responsible for. But this all being done in the context of the chief requirement being you look at the entire amount raised at the event and you attribute it to each of the co-hosts equally, and then, you know.
Yeah, but where does the statute say that?
The statute simply requires, you know, it doesn't speak to this issue directly, but we do have legislative history that does speak directly to this question. And I know it's been marginalized here, both in the first panel and to some extent by Mr. Elias, the fact that, you know, the presumption or assumption that Senators Feingold and Obama lost and this isn't the law that they wanted.
I never said that.
Well, my impression of your comments were that this is not the law that those to your left are wanting to point to legislative history about.
That's different than Senator Obama and Senator Feingold. They're not sitting to my left.
No, but you know we're pointing to their comments.
And you don't represent them.
No, we don't.
Again, it's something I may have over you.
Hey, we'll comments to the commission, not to each other.
You know, my point is simply, I think the legislative history, the statements of the senators and Representative Van Hollen should be taken very seriously. They achieved a major victory in passage of this legislation, and their comments that we cite to in our written comments are with respect to the legislation that passed, not with respect to earlier bills that ended up being completely rewritten or tossed out. And Senator Feingold, for example, stated explicitly on the floor of the Senate that when two or more lobbyists are jointly involved in providing the same bundled contributions, as, for instance, in the case of a fundraising event co-hosted by two or more lobbyists, then each lobbyist is responsible for and should be treated as providing the total amount raised at the event. So the statute, you know, I concede is silent on this level of specificity, but we do have some view into what the principal sponsors of the legislation intended.
But the statute talks about what the campaign, how the campaign credits the bundlers. And if the campaign is not actually crediting somebody for, I mean, let's say, you know, I think we talked about this example earlier, the example where the campaign knows that the main guy at this event raised $20,000, and then there were a couple of other guys that raised $5,000. So why, and the campaign knows this, and they're not given those other two guys credit for having raised $15,000. They say those guys have raised $5,000, and if they raise another $10,000 apiece, then we'll give them credit for raising $15,000. So why under a statute that calls for disclosure of bundling of $15,000 or more would you want to have those other guys on the list?
Well, my fear is that, and the fear of the Campaign Legal Center, I think this is likely a fear that's shared by the principal sponsors, at least as represented in the comments they filed with you, is that these systems will be modified by members in an effort to evade disclosing the identities of some lobbyists who are bundling contributions for them. So yes, systems of credit may be working one way today, but if you adopt a regulation that, again, sets out a roadmap for a manner in which, you know, they could say, well, what we really think here is that at this co-hosted event, we're going to, you know, spread out our belief of who's responsible for
this.
Are
they going to lie? Is that what you're suggesting, that they're going to lie?
No, I'm suggesting that they may just start thinking about co-hosted fundraising events differently than they did in the past. And they may think that, well, maybe it's most honest and fair to attribute this money equally to all these players who, you know, work together to hold this event.
Let me go back to something that you were talking about before, Mark, and that's the chairman was talking about, because I'm not sure I get this. The difference between tracking and crediting.
I have one follow-up. I hear what you're saying. I don't think it's necessarily that they're going to lie. What you're saying is they're going to adjust their conduct to get around or be consistent with, depending on your point of view, the law, right? But if we go down that road now, where we go a little bit maybe broader than we might otherwise would, I read the AFL-CIO comments, and they say, well, that we got to be careful going that direction as well. I don't know if you've read their comments, but they raised some very good points to me that all of a sudden you're putting innocent actors on the outside into a overly inclusive disclosure regime. How do we go the way you want to go and not run afoul of the concerns the AFL-CIO raises?
Well, I would point to the fact that the House and the Senate took this burden upon themselves. It's been stated earlier here today. I'll repeat it. They changed the onus of the reporting to themselves from the lobbyists, and they certainly have the option of not asking, not accepting bundled contributions from individuals who might be put out in some way by the very fact that their names will then be reportable on the public record. You know, I think, but again, the burden and the responsibility falls on the candidate.
I hear you, but if they if the reporting regime, I understand all that, but if what we decide is covered by the reporting regime and it reaches out and covers conduct by the union that otherwise wouldn't be covered if we adopted something, for the sake of argument, more consistent with the statutory language, although the burden's been shifted to the committee, you're bringing in people who maybe really shouldn't have been credited for a bundle into the public eye, and in a way that they may not particularly like. And although we can say Congress put the burden on them, essentially them being themselves, that's not the same as being able to drag in the AFL-CIO. And my concern is once you go out there, it's sort of it's a jurisdiction of the commission issue, and then we get into discovery and all kinds of things. And I could imagine a situation where if we go that way, and then we have to get to the bottom of whether or not a report's accurate or what really happened somewhere. Trying to take discovery out of a union hall seems to me very problematic. First Amendment concerns, right to associate, that kind of thing. And I want to try to nip these issues in the bud before we get there. When the AFL-CIO raises concerns, I take those very seriously. And that's, I think, consistent with how Commissioner Weintraub was going. Different way to probably get to the same point in the road, but I want to try to get a handle on can we do both, go where you want to go, but yet not do violence to the issues that someone like the AFL-CIO raises, other than to say, well, the burden's not on them to report, it's on the campaigns. Well, I understand that, but is there more to it?
Well, I think this may be an instance where there's a fork in the road. I don't know if we can accommodate both the interests, you know, that I've articulated, and simultaneously address all of the concerns of the AFL-CIO. But again, I would point to the statutory language itself that urges the broadest possible disclosure to the extent that hard decisions need to be made in this rulemaking, and inevitably they will be and have to be. This commission should err, if you want to call it that. I wouldn't call it err. I would call it the commission should choose the broader disclosure path.
Sort of like in Wisconsin Right to Life, when close calls, the speaker wins. The same kind of concept, just the other direction for purposes of reaching regulation. Right, that kind of concept.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of that analogy. So,
no, I didn't think you would, but that's kind of what I think of. When you flip a coin, which way is it going to go? And you're saying when it flips, we should go in favor of more regulation.
Well, Congress said that.
Well, there's a distinction, though. Is it our discretion because of the way the statute's structured? Are you saying the statute mandates this, or is it something that we actually have a decision to make? Because under the APA, there is a difference when court looks at this kind of thing, whether it's something that we have to do versus part of our decision making. And I think that's part of where Commissioner Weintraub was going, at least that's kind of how I heard what I took from some of her questions.
Well, you know, whether or not the rule that you eventually promulgate complies with the requirements of the APA is, I think, a decision that I necessarily need to leave to another day. I'm not sure if, you know, it depends on what the this is that you choose to do. But.
Could I join in on this briefly?
Sure.
I don't think neither the campaign, the candidate, nor the commission should be placed in the position of the burden of determining the relative weights of who organized and brought in more money at a general fundraising event. The purpose of this law is disclosure only. It's not to restrict anything. It's not to forbid any fundraising events or activity. It's to disclose who are the lobbyists who are most involved in the fundraising campaign and past that threshold of bundling activity. You know, it's pretty straightforward and pretty simple to come out with the equal crediting of the co-hosts of the fundraising events. And if you try coming up with a system that prorates any of this or tries to determine who's more responsible and who's less responsible, you're opening up a huge hole in the disclosure regime that can easily be gamed or evaded. You know, many of the fundraising events, you were bringing up the labor unions, especially labor union events, will have, you know, 20 hosts of any particular fundraising event. And to try assigning relative weights that doesn't accommodate the funds that are brought in at the fundraising events is going to end up undermining this disclosure regime.
Thank you.
Can I add one point to this? Because you're right, our purpose is addressing you today. I just want to, A, reiterate that I'm here testifying on my own behalf, not on behalf of any of my clients. That said, I have never said that that Senator Obama or Senator Feingold, or for that matter, Senator Reid, who was, and I think deserves a fair bit of credit, was in fact the sponsor of this legislation. Go on, Thomas, look it up. This was the leader's bill. This was put in as S-1, which was his right. And he fought hard for this bill. And he and Senator Feingold and Senator Obama and a number of other Democratic senators and some Republicans along the way strengthened this bill, in my view, in moving it from being a LDA disclosure bill into an FEC disclosure bill. So I've never suggested that was a loss for anyone. In fact, I think it was a victory for disclosure. That said, it was a victory for a certain kind of disclosure. It was a victory for very accurate disclosure. It was a victory to make the campaigns who were in a better position to know who got credit for the money do the disclosure. You know, when I say that the old bill went out the window, the old bill would have been real rough justice. It would have been a bunch of lobbyists at the end of every quarter sitting down as they got ready to submit their lobbying disclosure form saying, geez, how much money do you think we raised last quarter? This is a much more rigorous bill. But in the rigors of the bill, it put the disclosure where the information lies, which is with the campaigns, the people who have to track these money, the people who have to track these events, the people who know whether an event, whether it's big or it's small or it's in Washington, D.C. or it's outside of Washington, D.C., who know what their budgets are, who know what an event is budgeted for. And I think this, when it was switched from one to the other, the intent was to make it about a campaign. What does a campaign believe has just happened? What does it believe has been raised for it, and by whom? And so I don't think it's a question of winners or losers. I think it was a strengthening of the bill, frankly, to do that. But I think it was also strengthening in part because it was a more accurate snapshot. So I just wanted to clarify the record on that.
Mr. Weintraub.
Can I go back to tracking and crediting? Explain to me in what circumstances a campaign would be tracking somebody's, the amount of money that somebody raised, but not crediting them for having raised that money, because that distinction is lost on me.
Well, mostly, you notice I didn't put in my comments a definition of crediting. I suggested the commission come up with one.
Feel free to suggest one.
I don't have a suggestion as I sit here today. I could imagine, and I don't have a fully formed view on this or hypothetical on this, but I do think it's important if they are. Whatever crediting means, we ought to say it so that there are not then opportunities to evade and there's also not traps for the unwary. If it means something, we ought to say what it means. It's the operative word in that provision of the statute, so we ought to define it. I suppose I could imagine a scenario where a contribution comes into a compliance person and it is tracked for purposes of putting on the FEC report, but there is no recognition given to the person who raised it. It wouldn't be in an event context. It would be in some other context where there's no recognition given to the lobbyist. There's no credit to them. I mean, they're not credited with it. Like I said, I didn't provide an alternative definition, but rather I suggest or a definition at all. I rather thought that it's something that the commission ought to wrestle through.
All right. You're not being entirely helpful to me as I wrestle.
Well, these gentlemen may have an idea.
I'm not down there, but maybe I can give a whack.
Well, I can talk to later, though.
Okay.
I want to take advantage of the time to,
good,
to
okay.
get
then
their
that's
thoughts.
Right. We can now talk after this is over.
That's
we
right. That's right. That's an unusual circumstance for you and I, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So moving on to another phrase that I'm going to solicit suggestions on, other means of recognizing. What might these other means be of recognizing? I mean, the easy case is somebody's got a tracking number, somebody's got a title that announces that they're a hill raiser, an innovator, you know, whatever titles these guys are using these days. But What else should we be trying to capture other than knowledge? Because I heard your Latin definition. I thought that was very erudite. But give me some more concrete suggestions here. Anybody?
Well, I'll quickly join in. I mean, I don't mean to be attacking McCain. I'm not attacking McCain, by the way. I mean, McCain has been participating in our disclosure program and, you know, letting us know how accurate our list is, striking names off, adding names to the list. However, I do want to go back to that example because as far as I can tell, he has no tracking number for these finance co-chairs. He just has assigned people, given them an informal title with the expectation that they're going to go out and do a lot of fundraising for him. And he knows they're doing a lot of fundraising, even without a specific tracking mechanism that's going on. So he's giving them credit for bringing in a great deal of money to his campaign. The NPRM really touched upon most fundraising is going to have either a tracking number, it's going to have titles, it's going to provide special access to fundraising events or the campaigns based upon how much the campaign knows that the bundler's bringing in. Sometimes it's just going to be an expectation that you've got someone who's good at fundraising and so they're part of your team out there fundraising. Otherwise, I mean, you've really discussed most of the types of designations that I am familiar with at this point. However, there is that one caveat that on some occasions a campaign just knows that this person is responsible for hosting fundraisers and bringing in a lot of money.
We stated in our comments, and I want to reiterate here today, that I think that the illustrations of what constitutes these means of recognizing that are included in the NPRM are great. We think that you've done a good job of identifying, I'll echo Craig, identifying the methods that are most commonly used. Again, I think the touchstone here at the end of the day is knowledge on the part of the candidate or the committee of that candidate. But I would encourage you to keep this illustrative list of what constitutes these practices that are proposed in the NPRM. And the most important point from my view is that you not convert this, as some commenters have suggested, to an exhaustive list, because I don't think you can identify all possible approaches to this activity here in the NPRM.
I've got more if you want, or we can, somebody else can talk.
I'll let the vice chair have
one more question, maybe. Mr. Holman, you seem to be the advocate for the pro rata approach, if I'm not mistaken.
Pro rata? No, not at all. I said if there is a written record, then, you know, I would prefer using that written record. Once you go into a fundraising event where there isn't a written record, then everyone should be credited who is hosting the fundraising equally with that. Any pro rata effort, absent a written record, is going to undermine the disclosure regime.
Do you think, credit could come in a number of different ways. I mean, knowledge, and I can see the argument that knowledge means that there's credit. But then if they're to monetize it and somebody walks into a fundraiser, and the whole idea of the fundraiser is to get George to come because he really knows one of the main hosts and to get to know the candidate. And so when the person walks in, he says, George, the person being sought, I'm one of the general partners of a partnership, and there's 100 partners in this thing, and we report as partners. And I think we're all going to be able to max out for you. So then at the end of the thing, the money hasn't come in right away, but the fundraiser has been a success. Now, what do you think should be done in a case like that? If the candidate wants to really give credit at that point on an allocated basis, not pro rata.
That's an interesting situation. I mean, I would...
It does happen that way, you know.
It has. I would normally assess the equal value of any checks that are coming in later because of the fundraising event as following the same disclosure regime of equal credit to whoever was co-hosting the fundraising event. The people who are responsible for organizing a co-hosting event, if the registered lobbyists or registrants, You know, they should be the ones assigned the equal value. And I do know that checks do roll in after a fundraising event. But if it's clear and obvious to the campaign that these checks are coming in because someone planned on showing up at the fundraising event, didn't make it, sent in a check because of it, whoever were the co-hosts and registered lobbyists and registrants ought to be given equal credit for those contributions. For disclosure purposes, let's emphasize this.
Can I just add one thing? I do think, and I think this came up in the last bit, if the commission goes that way, then it ought to modify the form somehow so that campaigns are not certifying under penalty of perjury that it's accurate, because the fact is it won't be. It will not be accurate that these people raise this money. And you ought to make the form clear that this is not trying to be a, because, you know, I could see a treasurer looking at this form and saying, but this isn't what happened. I know, I was there.
Can we actually explore that a little bit, because this gets at something that's in my mind, and it goes back to something Mr. Simon said on the first panel. I'm not going to give a hypothetical because that's almost going to limit it, and I don't want people to read into what I'm really thinking, but it seems to me a situation where somebody may tell a member of Congress, hey, I raised $20,000 for your event the other day or something. Is a member really going to remember to tell the treasurer that? Probably not. And ultimately, the treasurer is the one, in theory, who's signing the report and is the custodian of records. Or there may be a separate person, but in most smaller campaigns, mid-sized campaigns, it's the same thing. And I have a concern, not because I want to limit disclosure, but as a practical side on when this agency has to deal with that on the back end, situation where the treasurer honestly says, well, I didn't know. I didn't know that conversation happened. Whose fault is that, and what do we do in that situation? Because campaigns have multiple folks, right? And just to keep it going, because everybody hesitated, and that means I get to keep talking. In the first section here, where it talks about of each person reasonably known by the committee to be a person described in paragraph 7, which we're shorthanding as kind of a registered lobbyist, without getting into what paragraph 7 says in that debate. But what does reasonably known mean? Let's say you have a person named Robert Smith, but everybody knows him as like Butch Smith, right? And when the volunteer doing this stuff or helping the treasurer put together these reports, checks the lobbying disclosure reports and looks on the website, they don't see a name that matches, and they inadvertently forget. They don't forget. They don't realize they have to report. So there's a lot of moving parts in campaigns. And this is a disclosure regime, which people seem to think, well, that's the easy part. But it's sometimes not the easy part, and in fact, in a lot of ways, a much more important part of what the law is trying to do. So my concern is more the practical, when you have moving parts and that kind of thing, and to sort of go full circle with Mr. Elias said out of the gate, if we're trying to codify essentially what's a disclosure of what's already happening, is this going to force campaigns to change and put in more sort of people or less people or better lines of communication or whatnot as to who really is on point to know what the committee knew? And before I get done my very run-on sentence that doesn't make any sense at this point, what about the professional fundraisers hired that house a whole other set of records, and they track everything for their own purposes, not for crediting, but for their own desire to raise more money, irrespective of some concept of credit or what an elected official may or may not want to know for those purposes. How about we start with you, Mark? You may understand what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. My point, let me make my, before I answer, the point I was making slightly clearer. If we're going to say that everyone who attends an event who's listed on a host committee is either getting, a pro rata share or automatically getting assigned 100% or anything. If there's an automatic way, if either option one or option two is adopted, then I think we need to make clear, so that we don't later have disagreements with the Department of Justice, that this is the FEC's instruction. Because the fact is, I could see a campaign looking at that and saying, but it's not true. He didn't, in fact, bundle money. He didn't, in fact, raise a dime. He wasn't, in fact, responsible for a dime. He was not credited through written forms, through non-written forms, through formal, through winks, through nods. He was credited with Zippy. He's a bum. I didn't care if he was at the, when I found out he was at the event, he shouldn't have been at the event. I want to make sure there is a way that we're not going to have a standoff with treasurers and campaigns that won't sign the forms because they believe it to be untrue. And I realize it may be administratively more convenient for you all to say, let's just go 100, 100, 100, or 50, 50, 50, or whatever, wherever you do it. But I think that there is a fundamental issue here, which is that this is going to be so disjointed from reality in the minds of these campaigns that I think you need to find a way that they are not, in fact, certifying that, in fact, those people raised that money because, in fact, or bundled those funds because, in fact, they won't have in many, 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 many instances if we go that route. I think it is much better to have them certify as to what they believe the truth to be and go forward. The only other thing I wanted to make, which is, goes to part of your point, is in my comments, and it was at the very end, so I don't fault anyone for not having read them. I objected to the commission's urging people to keep more records. You know, you have a record-keeping requirement. My clients are familiar with it. You've put out policies over the year clarifying it. I don't believe you can urge. If you want to my clients are not required now to come up with a tracking system. They're not required now to hire a person to administer a credit system. If they have it and they know it, they have to report it. If they don't got it, they don't know it, they're not required to now institute some new system. I don't know if that's what the commission had in mind in its urging, but I have unurged to the extent people have asked me I looked in the orange book, wasn't in there. I looked in the thicker book with 11 on the front, it wasn't in there. I unurged.
Mark's response, I think, drives home the point how important it is that the commission reduce the amount of discretion as possible when it comes to determining what gets reported at what amounts. If you're going to allow the type of discretion that Mark is urging when it comes to hosting fundraising events, you're going to get that kind of debating and just worry on the behalf of treasurers and accountants as to how much do I award this host, how much do I award that host, is it accurate? As opposed to having more of a bright line test of just awarding each host an equal amount based on how much was brought into the fundraising events. You've got to try as much as you can to reduce the amount of discretion that's going on in this. But the second point I want to bring up is a proposal that is in the NPRM, which is excellent, and quite frankly, during the whole drafting of the legislation, I was urging this as well, and that is having a distinct, separate bundling schedule, which I believe you are going to go ahead with. This schedule is going to make it very clear that the numbers being reported here are not the numbers that count towards the campaign budget, they're not the numbers that are going to be double counted in itemized receipts and contributions. This is for disclosure purposes only, so you can get an idea as to how much lobbyists and registrants are playing a role in the fundraising of these campaigns. It's a different level of accountability. It's not that type of accountability.
Still under penalty of perjury, though. I agree with you in the big picture that it is a different kind of accountability, but treasurers, I know these kinds of treasurers that Mr. Elias is talking about where they're going to freeze and not want to sign it and all this other stuff, and then you get into big problems because then you have people not wanting to file reports and that kind of stuff. And I'm trying to figure out a way to balance this so that and your way makes some sense because if there's an objective criteria like somebody hosts or that kind of thing, but if there isn't, shouldn't have to create that. It should be what the reality is, so the report then becomes more accurate, not less. And I don't want inaccurate reports that are best guesses.
Can I ask a question? What if they don't host? What if they're a featured guest? What if they're listed as attending? What if they're listed as part of the host committee but not as a host? What if it's a special host? I mean,
well, my question is, how's the campaign view that?
Well, I keep arguing that it should be what the campaign thinks. But if we're gonna write in regulations that we're just taking 100%, is it just name on the invitation? Does it matter font size, placement? What if it goes on the back or the front? I mean, it just seems to me it's
you might want to, don't give us any ideas.
It's a very, it just seems to me it is,
notes.
It is.
How about
it
color?
Is,
should we factor that in?
At the risk of I feel like I am the most reform-minded here because I actually think the public has the right to know what actually happened. I don't think campaigns ought to be able to hide behind putting 100 people on an invitation and reporting the same number for 100 people. Whether it's 100%, 50%, 0.01%, they're obscuring from reality the truth. I want to know what John McCain, what a real number is for John McCain's lobbyists who bundle for him. Not a average number, not a we took the everyone whose name was on invitation number. I want to know the real numbers. And I find it odd because I feel like I said, I'm actually advocating, I think, more disclosure, more complete and accurate disclosure. What is the campaign actually crediting this person for? That's a number that's worth putting in the newspaper. You know, hey, John McCain gave this person credit for $200,000. That means something.
How come John McCain's the only one that gives credit? I don't understand this.
I started with Bush.
Just a real quick response,
if I
could.
It does go to a point you made earlier, and go ahead.
If you do that system of having 100 hosts and you allow the campaign to divvy it up among those 100 people, you are going to undermine the entire disclosure regime. They're going to end up being prorated 1/100th of how much money was brought in, and we'd lose the entire intent of this law.
But the reality is in some of these presidential ones, you do have a gazillion hosts and all kinds of tiers on the invite because you get a lot of people who want to put their name on the invite and they may not raise any money. And that's the concern I hear from Mr. Elias is that that's not accurate either to just give everybody full credit for everything because the campaigns aren't giving full credit for everything. And it's a balancing we have to come up with that the statute doesn't necessarily tell us the right answer. It's within what the agency's here for. Make these kinds of decisions, right? The statute doesn't really tell us how to answer this question. Do we all agree on that, or do you disagree with the?
I agree with that point, but I wanted to make one point with respect to your perjury concerns, and that is that I think there is a way to design the reporting forms themselves to accurately reflect what's being reported so as not to be raising perjury concerns for those who have to sign those reports, saying, for example, in the schedule that is used for reporting of co-hosted fundraisers, this is this line is the total amount of funds raised at this fundraising event co-hosted by a registrant for whom the candidate is required to disclose bundled contributions. And instead of saying, having the language of the form be able to be misinterpreted as each one of these candidates or each one of these lobbyists raised this amount of money. I mean, I think it's a question of wording. But I also want to get back to a comment Mark made a couple minutes ago with respect to his being the better reformer, the more ardent reformer at this table, and wanting more disclosure. And in all fairness, I think we are dealing with, we're weighing two different competing interests, and Mark has described a situation in which the information maybe isn't quite as accurate, depending on how you do it, as it might be. But Craig articulates the other end of the spectrum, which is no disclosure because you have the attribution spread out among such a large number of lobbyists that none of them meet the $15,000 threshold. And my concern articulated earlier regarding the possibility or even probability perhaps that campaigns would change the way they look at these events and structure these events so as to not require disclosure of their lobbyists who they may not want to be that closely affiliated with.
Isn't that a natural consequence of any long line drawing? Once you draw a line, people are going to act in a way consistent with that line. And simply because they may get close to that line or stay far away from that line, it's still a line, and they should be able to act accordingly.
Okay. Certainly. I mean, yes, and you can draw the line in a way that will make it pretty easy for people perhaps to evade disclosure completely, or you can draw the line elsewhere and require what, depending on how it's drawn, could result in misinterpretation or over-disclosure. Or if you have, as Senator Feingold suggested, and we reiterated in our comments, a part of the co-hosted fundraising reporting, including a listing of all other co-hosts, or even going one step beyond that, and while attributing the total amount to each of those co-hosts, also allowing the campaigns to use their own record keeping to attribute what they believe was a specific amount to those co-hosts within the context of this schedule that says every co-host was responsible for total dollar amount.
If I can just make a couple of points of clarification. Number one, I join my two colleagues
in
completely rejecting the pro rata share. So I'm not advocating the 100 the you take 100 and you divide it up. I think that that is as frustrating to reform and the intent of the statute as anything would be. And but I oppose the opposite, which is we just take it all and we attribute it to everybody. I'm arguing for the third way, which is we try to get as close to the reality of who got credit for each check. So I don't want the commission to misinterpret. I don't support the pro rata approach either.
Three questions. Okay. One, first question is suggested by this last exchange, and try and keep it focused. I think that Mark raises an interesting concern about the possible obscuring effect of having too much disclosure. It's like a document dump in discovery, where you know you've got one bad fact in there, so you try and bury it under a mound of paper and hope they won't notice. And this is sort of the flip side of the scenario that I was talking about with Don Simon earlier, where, you know, maybe somebody wouldn't write down Jack Abramoff because you don't want that name to show up on your disclosure. So for him and him alone, you'd have the unwritten recognition. But, you know, here's the flip side. Suppose that Jack Abramoff actually did raise $100,000 and you want to dilute that. You say, well, okay, we'll just, you know, say, well, really, even though we know that he's the guy that brought in all the money, we're going to add all these other, this is great, we're going to add in all these other co-hosts, and then it looks like he didn't do as much, he wasn't as significant a figure in our fundraising operation as he really was. So I just wanted to ask quickly, Mr. Ryan, whether you have any concerns about that kind of obscuring effect of just assuming that everybody raises everything.
I do have concerns, but they're not as great as my concerns that an alternative approach could result in less or no disclosure.
All right, fair enough. Second question, I want to go back to the issue of who speaks for the registrant, because you had said earlier, Paul, that if a non-lobbyist is acting on behalf of the registrant and the registrant's getting credit, then that should be disclosed. And that seems reasonable, except how do we know when they're acting on behalf of the registrant? And I come at this from a real point of confusion, because I'm struggling to find a way to give content to this requirement that the registrant's bundling has to be disclosed, because I don't think I've ever seen an organization listed as a bundler on any of these voluntary disclosures. Am I wrong about that?
Could be, sure. I believe Emily's List files bundling disclosure reports. They're an organization.
Oh, okay.
Partnerships, which are permissible bundlers, could file disclosure. There are other federal PACs that would be organizations.
Okay, so how do we know when somebody's acting on behalf of the registrant?
I'm happy to just state briefly that I've testified before this commission previously about the concept of agency. How do you deal with agents under FECA and BCRA? And I think that's the concept that needs to be employed here, and it is not always the neatest concept. I was here for the first panel, and I was intrigued that Mr. Sandler was advocating broader disclosure in this context than we, the Campaign Legal Center, did in our written comments. But I think without consulting with my colleagues, I'm going to stick to our approach we advocate, which was require any agent of a registrant to be covered by the statute.
And if I could double that, speaking as the person who filed the Freddie Mac complaints, you folks did an excellent job of determining that Mitch Delk was working as an agent on behalf of Freddie Mac. You have established your standards of determining who is an agent of a corporation or a registrant, and that would be the principle that would be applied here.
Give you an opportunity to weigh in.
Yeah, I in my comments take a somewhat more cautious approach. Where Congress has wanted to loop in agents, they have done so expressly and explicitly. They chose not to do so here. Presumably they knew how to do it because they did it in McCain-Feingold in several instances. Obviously in the organizational context, there has to be some way of looping it in, because corporations only act, or for that matter any organization only act through its officers, employees, and in that sense agents. So my caution about agents is actually less around the organizational situation. It is more, there was a question I think raised whether or not if I as a non-lobbyist host do an event, it should automatically attribute in some form or fashion to either the law firm I work for or some other registered lobbyist. And it seems to me that that in that instance there is no agent acting on behalf of. I mean, you know, the statute doesn't talk about agency in that context.
Can I just add real quickly that I think that the FECA has been interpreted by this commission to include or cover agents in many areas where the statute doesn't explicitly include agents. And I'll just point to 11 CFR 114.2F, which is regarding corporations and unions facilitating the making of contributions. There's other examples, but the statute doesn't mention agents there. The regulations do, appropriately.
The other concern I would have, which I'm sure my colleagues will share, they may not share the solution, but they'll share the concern, is I don't think the commission wants to open up a suggestion that corporations are now permitted to bundle contributions. I mean, the fact is it has been, in fact, I believe, Commissioner, you wrote eloquently in a matter involving an energy company from Kansas City, can't forget the name of it,
Westar,
about the fact that corporations are not permitted to bundle contributions. And I don't want any regulation here to suggest that somehow by listing it somehow becomes permissible activity.
My understanding is there are exceptions to the ban on corporate union facilitation of making of contributions for activities within their restricted classes, and I think some of those activities would meet the definition of bundling in this statute and should be covered. So I think it's oversimplification to say corporations can't bundle. I think they can under some circumstances, but I
agree with that, but I don't think there should be a suggestion that it's opening up some what had been impermissible to date is now permissible.
And I want to ask one more question, a brand new topic. Nobody's we talked about this at all today. The concept of when the statute tries to capture disclosure of bundling by PACs that are established or controlled by registrants and lobbyists. And it's easy to see it in the SSF context that it's established by a registrant, if indeed the affiliated organization is a registrant. But what about a non-connected committee? At what point should we deem a non-connected committee to be controlled by a lobbyist? Secretary of the Senate, the Clerk of the House, in their Lobbying Disclosure Act guidance and their HALOGA guidance have suggested that if a lobbyist is on the board or perhaps is the treasurer, that would be an indicia of control. Should we, although the example they use makes it a little bit ambiguous, should we defer to that? Should we come up with a different definition? And if so, what would it be? Anybody?
We all want to answer.
I'll jump in first. I think that we would support a rule that established that a lobbyist who is on the board of a non-connected committee or is an officer makes that per se controlled by the lobbyist. I would also advise or suggest that the commission look to its own regulations regarding establishing, financing, maintaining, and control, because you have a couple parts in your regulations, 100.5G4, sub 2 and 300.2C both get into this concept. And I acknowledge readily that it's not a neat fit, but there may be some language in there that would be helpful.
The commission's already tackled issues like this very, very well in a tried and true sense. The commission's definition of affiliation, for instance, has three indicia that I think could be used. The entity directs or participates in the governance of the organization. The entity hires or fires within the organization, or the entity does an ongoing fundraising role within the organization. That would seem to be an appropriate definition of control to me.
I like the idea of tying to the commission's existing regulations if possible. I realize, as Paul does, that there are probably limitations there, but I believe the fewer competing definitions for the same words that appear in the statute is good. Although I haven't looked at those regulations recently, so I don't know where that leads us. Treasurer, I would say for sure, would be. I mean, after all, that's the person whose name you put on the nice letters that Ms. Duncan's office sends me and my clients periodically. And beyond that, I'd be hesitant to say that per se board membership is control. Just because very often these boards can be very large and honorific in nature, I'd want something a little bit more practical than that. But you know, I think you're looking at who actually controls it, not not that someone's listed as one of 50 people on an honorific board that they have, that they exercise no power on. Because remember, most of these are not corporate, and most of the non-connected PACs are unincorporated associations, and they don't really have a true governing board. The board is very often just there for public consumption, not for actual governance purposes.
General Counsel.
I know we're very short on time. I just want to ask. I just want to ask this panel the question that I asked the last panel about the issue of non-lobbyists who are employees of registrants and how and whether the rules apply there. And I know we have the suggestion to apply the agency standard, and that's something that we at this agency can do, obviously, and have done. But isn't the more relevant question on the part of the reporting committee, how do they know when the CEO, for example, is acting individually as a volunteer or acting, you know, on behalf of the actual registrant? As a practical matter, how does that work? Really addressing this to Mr. Holman, but others can answer.
Okay, Paul could have answered this probably better, but I would stick to the, I reiterate the agency standard. I mean, it's a matter for the commission to determine if there's some sort of red flag that draws your attention to the role of a CEO who's not a registered lobbyist and his or her role in the fundraising. You know, you've got to apply the principles of the agency standard in determining whether or not that CEO is working on behalf of the organization or the registrant or on behalf of a lobbyist. That is something that you've got to determine in an audit process. You know, generally, I would certainly, a CEO who is not a registered lobbyist and is not acting on behalf of his or her corporation or registrant and does a fundraising event in his or her home, that is not someone who, in my opinion, would be captured in the bundling provision. It's when they're actually working as an agent or perhaps using the registrant's property or on the registrant's time, or, you know, something on that order, which all falls within your agency standard.
Can I say a word about, we've talked a lot about various pieces of legislative history. The Senator Reid, who, as I mentioned, was actually the technical primary sponsor of the legislation, along with Senator Feinstein, who was the chair of the Rules Committee, which had jurisdiction over the lobbying disclosure pieces, you're going to correct me when I get this wrong, and Senator Lieberman, who is chair of the committee that had jurisdiction over, I have this backwards.
Senator Lieberman had the LDA.
Had the LDA, and Senator Feinstein had the campaign finance, submitted a joint statement of legislative history in the record, which actually addresses this head on, and I would commend the commission to look at it carefully and follow it. They make clear that only contributions credited to registered lobbyists are covered. Contributions credit to others, including others who may share a common employer with or work for a lobbyist, are not covered by this section, so long as any credit is genuinely received by the non-lobbyist and not the lobbyist. To me, your question belies, again, what I think is the fundamental divide over how to view this. My own view is it's not about agency. It's about credit. Okay? At the end of the day, I'll end where I began. At the end of the day, when the member sat back after that event, they say to themselves, geez, that was a great event that Fred just threw for me. Or did they say, you know what, I'm giving the company credit for this event. I think it's driven by how they view it. If they are viewing it, if they are offering credit through records, designation, or other form of recognition to the company, then it's the company. And if they are doing that for the individual, then it's the individual. And I think ultimately we need to not view this as I fear sitting in an enforcement action with you all years from now, in which I am being told by a lawyer at OGC that my client, the candidate, is wrong in who they credited. And I'll just say right now, that will be an absurd place. If a candidate credits an individual, it is not the place of this agency to say, no. You actually should have credited the organization, or you should have credited a different individual. The statute, I think, is clear on this. And to answer your question, I don't think it's a matter of agency discretion. I think the agency would be acting outside of the bounds of the law if it interpreted it otherwise. I'm sorry.
And I guess I suppose that if there's a discrepancy between the reporting committee and the individual who's being credited as to what or on whose behalf he or she is acting, that will just get worked out between
No, I don't think there's a I don't think there's a competition. Understand, the fundraising community is full of individuals and entities that claim credit for things that they don't receive it. Right? I mean, it is common the place that someone believes they have done more for a candidate than the candidate does. My point is it doesn't get sorted out. It is ultimately what is the view, the subjective view of the campaign that ought to control in the statute, because the statute speaks about who is crediting. It is not an objective crediting.
So if the CEO thinks he's doing this voluntarily, as I think Commissioner Hunter raised earlier, but then, you know, the reporting committee, for whatever reason, decides they're going to give the credit to the corporation, that's the situation I'm
talking about. Then it should be reported. If the purpose of this statute, I go back to the beginning, is to figure out who's getting juice with the member, right? Who does the member feel that much, maybe it's only that much, but that much beholden to or thankful to? And if they're feeling that way towards the company, then God bless, they ought to put down the company. And if it's the individual, though, they ought to put down the individual. And there ought not to be a MER, you know, someone from OGC sitting around saying, well, I think you credited it wrong. Well, then you run for Congress, and then you can credit it however you want.
Once again, I want to reiterate, that type of discretion and this type of reporting regime would undermine the entire disclosure element of the law. You can't provide that type of wide leeway in discretion and just leave it an entirely discretionary disclosure system. And that is what Mark is proposing. You know, suppose you had the traditional Pioneer tracking number system on the checks, but the candidate wanted to say, but I'm really giving credit to someone else. You just can't leave that type of discretion overreaching the entire disclosure regime.
I'm not saying that campaigns get to lie. I mean, if in fact they are giving credit to person A, they're not allowed to just choose person B.
This concludes our hearing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You might want to
find them about
yeah.
to be kept. Yep, that's
yeah.
right.
Thank you. I could have turned you off just
in the first panel, we indicated that the record's going to be held open for a week in the event you want to file supplemental comments or flesh anything out that happened here today. Particularly if you have any idea what the reporting form would look like, that may help. It's one way to sidestep the prorate versus reality debate and all that. Maybe there's a way that someone can creatively figure out a report that's something that I'm looking for. Or whatever else you may wish to submit, it'll be open for a week. And this concludes our hearing on the proposed lobbyist bundling rules. I'd like to thank everyone who appeared before us. Your time and expertise on the matter would no doubt help assist the commission in deciding a very important issue, and as Mr. Elias said, a brand new area for the commission that is not rooted in the mid-1970s in the history since. It's a chance for the commission to do something anew, and we appreciate the help you've given us. That the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.